Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, September 11th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Kurt Schillinger, Managing Editor. The assassination of a young conservative activist has brought a moment of reflection to a nation that in recent years has seemed to be exploring its tolerance for violence as an acceptable form of political expression. Charlie Kirk left a lot of tracks. He amplified the less restrained rhetoric of the Trump era, yet in the final moments of his life on a college campus in Utah on Wednesday afternoon, he was doing what may be more important than the sum of his words, debating and encouraging a hesitant and skeptical new generation to participate rather than recede. Among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union, none deserves to be more accurately developed than its tendency to break and control the violence of faction, James Madison argued. Now on to the first story. Charlie Kirk's killing sparks calls to temper the violent tones of U.S. politics by Story Hinckley and Patrick Johnson. The killing of Charlie Kirk, a conservative activist and preeminent leader of the young MAGA right, has stirred an outpouring of sorrow and condemnations of political violence from members of both major parties. Mr. Kirk died on Wednesday after he was shot while speaking to roughly 3,000 people at Utah Valley University. He was at the Orem, Utah campus launching his American Comeback Tour, in which he engaged college students across the country in provocative, sometimes fiery, political debates. Officials at a news conference said they believed the shooting was a targeted attack towards one individual. While the motive for the shooting remains unknown, Utah Republican Governor Spencer Cox called it a political assassination and urged all Americans to engage in self-reflection. We just need every single person in this country to think about where we are and where we want to be, he said. To ask ourselves, is this it? Is this what 250 years has wrought on us? I pray that that's not the case. Mr. Kirk's fatal shooting comes at a time of heightened political violence in America against Republicans and Democrats alike, including last year's assassination attempts against then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, an arson attack on the home of Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro, and the slaying of former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman, also a Democrat, and her husband in June. Leaders from both parties strongly condemned Mr. Kirk's shooting. Utterly devastating, wrote Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson on X, adding, every political leader must loudly and clearly decry this violence. Political violence is never acceptable, posted House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries. President Trump ordered the nation's flags lowered to half-staff. Violence and threats against elected officials and public figures have spiked in recent years, as political rhetoric has darkened and grown more existential. Officials from the two major parties have repeatedly decried the violence and urged restraint, but polarizing and dehumanizing speech has also become far more commonplace. And though some data suggests that recent political violence has actually decreased voters' hostility toward the opposing party, incidents like what happened on Wednesday afternoon remain far too common. To many, America feels like a tinderbox. and it might require a sustained effort and bipartisan political will to get back to a more civilized place. The last era of political violence, at least at the scale we're witnessing now, was in the 1960s and 70s, and it took a long time to come out of that era, says Matthew Dalek, a political historian at George Washington University. I imagine that the country will come out of this era at some point, but it's hard to see how that happens. It's hard to see how institutions, individual leaders, civic society, really the culture, pushes back effectively to begin to curb its frequency and its allure and its impact. Many on the left saw Mr. Kirk as a reckless provocateur. He once called transgender people an abomination, and on Wednesday was answering a question regarding transgender mass shooters when the shot rang out. His supporters saw the young Republican as a fearless defender of conservative beliefs and Christian values, willing to hold political arguments in unfriendly territory such as overwhelmingly liberal college campuses. Americans on both sides have noted that Mr. Kirk was killed while engaging his opponents openly through ideas and speech. Charlie believed in the power of free speech and debate to shape ideas and to persuade people, said Governor Cox. Historically, our university campuses have been the place where truth and ideas are formulated and debated. And that's what he does. He comes on college campuses and he debates. Some politicians were quick to blame one another for the escalation in rhetoric that led to Mr. Kirk's shooting. After a moment of silence in Congress on Wednesday, Representative Anna Paulina Luna, a Republican from Florida who was close with Mr. Kirk and credited him with getting her into politics, yelled across the aisle to Democrats that they caused this. Others on the left have pivoted to Mr. Kirk's own comments after Paul Pelosi, the husband of former Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was attacked in the couple's California home, calling for a hero to bail the attacker out of jail. President Trump released a video statement from the Oval Office on Wednesday evening in which he called on all Americans and the media to confront the fact that violence and murder are the tragic consequences of demonizing those with whom you disagree. But he pointedly accused one side of doing the demonizing, saying, "For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today, and it must stop right now." Others say Mr. Trump himself bears more responsibility for the current combustible climate than anyone else. For the last 10 years, the most important political figure in the world has made a pattern of promoting and endorsing political violence, says Peter Simi, a sociologist at Chapman University who studies extremist violence. As examples, he points to the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in August 2017, and the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. One of the things we know absolutely is necessary is for there to be leadership on this at the top, Dr. Simi says. If that's not there, other efforts are going to be minimally effective at best. Roughly 3/4 of all Americans said politically motivated violence was a major problem for America in an NPR PBS News Marist poll conducted in June. But polling also shows that many Americans see political violence as a legitimate method to achieve political goals, says Brian Levin, founding director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. Mr. Levin points in particular to the impact of an unfiltered and extreme information environment, with many people now getting their news and having their opinions shaped by social media. We've always balanced freewheeling politics with civic norms, but the problem is now there are no guardrails, because the exposure to all kinds of social and political discourse is not managed or edited by the local newspaper editor or the head of the Kiwanis Club or the soccer coach or the Sunday school teacher, says Mr. Levin. It's an unmoderated tsunami of jetsam coupled with accessibility to firearms. Mr. Kirk had been a leading Republican voice since his founding of Turning Point USA in 2012, when he was 18 years old. The organization says it has chapters on more than 3,500 high school and college campuses across the country, helping register young voters, bringing right-wing figures to speak on campus, and offering camaraderie for fellow conservatives. By 2024, Turning Point USA had grown to an almost $85 million organization. Mr. Kirk also oversaw Turning Point Action, the political action group that branched off from his original organization. His American Comeback Tour was scheduled to include 14 additional events during September and October at colleges and universities across the country. Mr. Kirk, who married in 2021 and has two small children, was arguably one of the most influential figures in the MAGA movement, becoming a close friend of the president's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., as well as then-Senator J.D. Vance, whom he promoted for the vice presidential slot. He hosted a popular conservative radio show, The Charlie Kirk Show, which released episodes daily. But Mr. Kirk might have been best known for his social media activities, in which he would criticize Democrats and their policies to millions of followers on X, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. Mr. Kirk spoke at the last three Republican national conventions, despite never holding elected office or an official position within the White House. Mr. Kirk has long been one of Mr. Trump's trusted confidants. The president has credited Mr. Kirk and his army of young people for helping him improve his margins among young people during the 2024 election. "I want to thank Charlie," said Mr. Trump at an event in January before his inauguration. "Charlie's fantastic. I mean, this guy. Don't believe the stuff when you hear the kids are liberal. They're not liberal. Maybe they used to be, but they're not anymore." Mr. Kirk has spoken publicly about the threats he faced while growing Turning Point USA. When asked by someone in 2023 why he was filming their interaction, Mr. Kirk said that cameras were the greatest protection he had in a video posted on YouTube. "We record all of it so we can put it on the internet so people can see those ideas collide. When people stop talking, that's when you get violence. That's when civil war happens, because you start to think the other side is so evil and they lose their humanity," said Mr. Kirk. "I think what makes this country on the verge of going to a place we don't want to go right now is we're afraid to go to places like this and have these conversations. I'm not." Next story. After failed Israeli Hamas assassination, are Gaza peace talks possible? By Dina Kraft, reporting from Tel Aviv, Israel. At around 4 in the afternoon, Middle East time on Tuesday, Israeli Air Force jets reached their targets after a flight of over 1,000 miles, unleashing a missile attack on a dusty pink building in the capital of Qatar, Doha. The pilots had been told that Hamas's senior leaders were meeting there to consider an American proposal for an end to the war in Gaza. Israeli officials were quick to take responsibility for the attack in celebratory tones. But on Wednesday, it emerged that the missiles had missed their targets and that the Hamas leaders had survived. That adds bite to the question many Israelis were already asking themselves. What was the strategy behind this high-risk strike in the territory of an important U.S. ally, whose government has been hosting and brokering peace talks between Israel and Hamas? The logic appeared to be that wiping out Hamas's leadership abroad would oblige Hamas's military leaders on the ground in Gaza to agree to a deal on Israel's terms. That would give Israel its long-sought and elusive total victory over the fundamentalist Islamic group that started the longest war in Israeli history with its massacre of over 1,000 Israeli civilians and seizure of hostages on October 7, 2023. That victory would secure the immediate release of the remaining hostages, 20 of whom are believed still to be alive, and the disarmament of Hamas. This is the same logic that has guided the Israeli government since the beginning of the war, that more pressure on Hamas will help release hostages and perhaps end the war, says Ksenia Svetlova, executive director of the Regional Organization for Peace, Economics, and Security, a nonprofit conflict resolution group. Israel's government wants Hamas to raise a white flag and say, "We lost, you won. Here are the hostages, and we have no demands. We will commit harakiri together, and you can do in Gaza whatever you want," says Ms. Svetlova, a former Israeli lawmaker. As Israeli elections approach, each party wants to appear as powerful and uncompromising as possible to their base, says Ms. Svetlova. Meant to prolong the war? The left-wing daily Haaretz saw Tuesday's operation as a bid to prolong the war in Gaza. When a state tries and, even more troubling, succeeds in assassinating the interlocutors, even indirectly, it's clear that it has no interest in negotiations, its editorial read. The operations didn't eliminate Israel's enemies, and there's nothing to celebrate. What it did eliminate were our chances to end the war, finally secure the hostages' release, halt Israel's political and reputational collapse, stop the bloodshed of thousands in Gaza, and bring an end to the nightmare that has haunted Israel and Gaza for nearly 2 years, the editorial continued. Top Israeli army and Mossad officials opposed the strike, according to media reports, fearing that it would torpedo efforts to save Israel's hostages. The war is taking a devastating toll on both Israeli and Palestinian society, and pressure has mounted on both leaderships to end it. Over 62,000 people in Gaza have been killed, according to the Hamas-affiliated Gaza Health Ministry. Israel's losses are less tangible, but nonetheless grave. "We will pay a price internationally for this," Rami Igra, the former head of the Missing Persons Unit in Mossad, told Israel Radio. If it is true that Washington was alerted to the attack only just before the missiles were launched, he said, in the end, Israel may now face even bigger American pressure to end the war. Some Israeli analysts with military backgrounds, such as Eyal Pinko, view the attempted assassination as an important message to Qatar. The authorities were, they say, implicated in the deaths of Israelis through their patronage of Hamas. "They are not peacemakers. This is the duplicity of Qatar," says Dr. Pinko, a senior research fellow at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Israel's Bar Ilan University. "We cannot be fooled by Hamas anymore, after almost 2 years of back and forth of negotiations," says Dr. Pinko. Hamas has been unwilling to agree to a ceasefire agreement. This strike is a way to bring chaos to this organization by cutting off the head of the snake. So I think it's a smart move. Meanwhile, the hostages' families are terrified for the fate of their loved ones, fearing retribution by their Hamas captors. A grave fear now hangs over the price that the hostages may pay, reads a statement from the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. The chance of bringing them back now faces greater uncertainty than ever before. With one thing of absolute certainty, their time is running out. The price for the 48 hostages could be unbearable. The living hostages could be murdered at any moment, and the deceased could disappear forever. Next story. Israel ordered them to leave. Many in Gaza City say there is nowhere left to run. By Gada Abdul Fattah, reporting from Gaza City, Gaza Strip. Hundreds of slips of black paper swarmed the sky over Gaza City on Tuesday morning, then fluttered down onto its bomb-blasted streets. Printed on each was the same curt order from the Israeli military to the residents of Gaza City: for your safety, evacuate immediately. As Israel presses a major offensive to take control of the city, the reasons for residents to follow its orders were clear. But very often, the decision was not. Displacement is the war itself, explains Ayman al-Atol, a father of eight whose family has spent the past 2 years moving around Gaza City in search of safe places to shelter. Today, the family lives in a tent in the former commercial district of Saraya, where makeshift encampments fill streets that once bustled with shoppers, office workers, and families. The war is not about airstrikes, he says. We have become numb to that. It is about moving from one place to another. By the time the evacuation warnings fell from the sky, many here had already been debating the decision to stay or go for weeks. 2 weeks ago, a hunger monitoring agency backed by the United Nations declared a famine in Gaza City. In mid-August, the Israeli cabinet approved plans for a sweeping takeover of Gaza City, designed to eliminate what it says is Hamas's last remaining stronghold in Gaza. In the days that followed, the Israeli military called up 60,000 reservists and began blowing up high-rise towers in the city that it said Hamas fighters were using as lookout points, the buildings used to shelter hundreds of Palestinian families. The military urged Palestinians to evacuate to a hurriedly resketched humanitarian corridor in southern Gaza. It included the decimated city of Khan Yunis, as well as neighboring Mawazi, a makeshift displacement camp on a strip of sandy coastline that already has a population density of about 121,000 people per square mile, and is almost entirely without sewage, running water, or medical facilities. Despite being declared a safe zone for civilians, Israeli forces have repeatedly shelled and rocketed the area, as recently as May of this year. For many Gaza City residents, fleeing to Mawazi feels no safer than staying put. They bomb everywhere, says Nadia Abu Hijala. Since October 2023, she had been displaced nearly 10 times before finally returning here to the rubble of the city where she was born. Now, the mother of seven is firm in her decision. Since there is no safe place, I will not move, she says. At least here, we stay with dignity. But standing beside Ms. Hijala, her daughter Iman, isn't as sure. Displacement, she agrees, was unbearable. Days and nights without water, without food, surrounded by disease and death. Every time we try to settle, we lose everything again. Still, as the younger Ms. Hajila hugs her infant son against her chest, her resolve slackens. "I am afraid I might lose my child if I stay here," she confesses. By the beginning of this week, Israel had taken control of about 40% of Gaza City and claimed to have destroyed at least 50 high-rise residential buildings. "Staying in the area is very dangerous," warned the flyers that rained over Gaza City on Tuesday. But on the ground, there seemed to be little fear. Women kept hair appointments at their local salons. Couples prepared for wedding parties. Local supermarkets advertised their weekly specials, and neighbors bickered over their fences about who left garbage in their yard. For many, the decision to stay put was simply practical. A move would cost enormous sums of money. Renting a truck to transport a family's belongings would cost around $1,000. And buying a tent to pitch at Mawazi would cost another $1,000. And the move would further drain emotional resources long ago spent. "The situation is horrific right now, but I can tolerate it. I can tolerate it more than being displaced," explains Dana Al-Lababidi, a university lecturer. "We are already exhausted, mentally broken, disappointed, and desperate," says Mr. Otal. "In the past 2 years, his family has already been uprooted 4 times. One of Mr. Otal's adult sons, injured by Israeli soldiers, can no longer walk. It takes 8 people to carry him on a mattress, making it extremely difficult for the family to move. I always think of him, of his safety," Mr. Otal says. "The fear of losing him never leaves me." For her part, the elderly Ms. Hajila was simply tired. "Gaza City is my land," she says. "If we die, we die here." You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story, cellos and camaraderie. This youth organization is an instrument of connection. For 28 years, an after-school program run by Community Music Works has been reimagining what access to classical music education looks like. By Troy Aiden Sambajon, Providence, Rhode Island. The melodies drifting from Community Music Works' spacious building are more than just the sounds of young musicians practicing. They are the heartbeat of the neighborhood. For 28 years, an after-school program run by the Providence, Rhode Island-based nonprofit has been reimagining what access to classical music education looks like. Community Music Works operates in areas of the state where K-12 students might not otherwise be able to afford to play stringed instruments. The program allows students to use instruments at no cost, offers mentorship, and hosts free concerts and workshops for the wider community to attend. Eli Erisis, 10, is starting his 4th season in CMW this fall. On the last day of summer camp in late July, he and his fellow campers are performing original songs for their parents using violins, violas, cellos, and shakers they crafted out of cardboard. Bobbing to the rhythm inside CMW's auditorium, Eli's parents, Shirley and Walter Arises, say they could not be happier. During the school year, Eli spends an hour nearly every day at group practice at CMW and up to 2 hours for weekly individual lessons. Since joining the program, Eli listens to music with a newfound appreciation and even picks up sheet music at home to read for fun. His parents hope to enroll Eli's siblings in the program. The proud parents share a love of music, and Eli's father says his son's orchestral playing is like adding another genre for all of us to enjoy. He's even learning to play Bohemian Rhapsody on viola, Eli's mother chimes in. In an era when many schools' art budgets are dwindling, CMW offers something increasingly rare, a space where young people find joy, purpose, and camaraderie through music, the music of change. CMW's beginnings were modest. In 1997, while he was a senior at Brown University, Sebastian Ruth launched the program with a $10,000 grant and a vision for what he termed musicianship working for positive social change. Mr. Ruth grew up in Ithaca, New York, and was first inspired by a high school violin teacher who encouraged him to think about the social and spiritual impact of music on people. He and a small team rented a tiny storefront in Providence's West End neighborhood, one of the city's most diverse but also most economically disadvantaged areas, and began offering free violin lessons. For most working-class families here, private lessons were financially out of reach, and orchestral music was something encountered only from a distance. Within a few years, CMW expanded to the building next door to accommodate its growing after-school program. Hundreds of students later, CMW has cemented its place in the neighborhood with a new state-of-the-art facility, which opened in September 2024. At its street-facing entrance, floor-to-ceiling windows and six-foot-tall red letters that spell out the group's initials offer a bold welcome to all who pass by. The three-story building has a performing arts center, group practice rooms, an instrument repair workshop, and plenty of space for lessons. Financing for the $15 million project came from state and local funds, as well as individual donations. Alexis Marie Nelson started her CMW journey in the sixth grade in 2006. It led her to study violin and viola, and to eventually graduate from the Boston Conservatory at Berklee College of Music. Now a program coordinator at CMW, she says the nonprofit has evolved over the years, with the new facility allowing for large audiences to gather. "We just have the possibility to have our entire community under one roof," Ms. Nelson says. "The connections that we're making are so important. Feels like home." Inside the building, teens such as Cesar Mendez shuffle in and out of lessons and jam sessions. They engage in soul-searching discussions about music and identity. "This place feels like home," says Mr. Mendez, an 18-year-old violist who joined the program nearly a decade ago. "It's just full of life." But the real impact goes beyond mastering scales. The arts aren't just about skill building or learning to play an instrument, Mr. Ruth says. It's a different way of being with other people. Many communities, particularly urban communities, are just doing a disservice to the children by not having adequate opportunities to learn the arts, he adds. "Learning music is more than an elective activity," notes Cecil Adderley, chair of music education at Berklee College of Music and president of the National Association for Music Education. "It's a way to model how to excel at something artistic." "Even if students never go pro," he adds, "they're using their creativity as well as fostering collaboration and a sense of belonging. You're learning not just how to be a musician, but how to be a better neighbor." CMW nurtures a feeling of connection as well as curiosity and leadership. A lot of the time, We talk just so we don't feel alone in the questions we have, says Mr. Mendez, who will study biomedical engineering at the University of Rhode Island this fall. Next story. Russia waves away blame after its drone incursion in Poland. Moscow's defenders argue that the incursion of Russian drones into Polish airspace on Wednesday night might be a Ukrainian conspiracy. Critics say it's simply the Kremlin testing Western resolve. By Fred Weir, reporting from Moscow. Russia has responded ambiguously to NATO allegations that it sent a wave of military drones into Polish territory during a large air raid in western Ukraine early Wednesday, adding more uncertainty to a war already complicated by the incursion. The Russian Defense Ministry has insisted only that there had been no plans to attack any target in Poland. Polish officials said that at least 14 Russian combat drones entered Polish airspace, leading NATO aircraft to scramble and shoot down at least four of them. Poland immediately invoked NATO's Article 4, which triggers a consultation process among the transatlantic allies over a putative security threat to any member. Following that meeting, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte issued a statement denouncing Russia's reckless behavior and urging stepped-up vigilance against further violations of the alliance's airspace. The Kremlin declined to comment, and, in a twist that suggests it wants the matter to be viewed as a technical misunderstanding rather than a political crisis, referred journalists to the Russian Defense Ministry. The ministry admitted in a subsequent statement that it had launched a major drone assault against western Ukraine in that time frame, but insisted it had no intention of hitting anything in Poland. The Defense Ministry statement blamed Poland for blowing the issue out of proportion, but added that in order to fully clarify what happened for all parties interested in preventing further escalation of the situation, the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation is ready to hold consultations with the Ministry of Defense of the Republic of Poland on this topic. The incident is the worst to potentially threaten a third party in the 3.5-year-old Russian war against Ukraine, which has seen several examples of Ukrainian and Russian drones and missiles go astray and land on NATO territory. Those mistakes were sometimes blamed on the intense electronic warfare measures being deployed by all sides. Russian defense expert Viktor Litovkin, the military editor at the official TASS news agency, says that the whole affair is quite murky. For one thing, he says, citing Western news reports, the remains of Russian drones so far found in Poland indicate that they were harmless decoys and not armed assault vehicles. Why would Russia send dummy drones into Poland, which had no warheads and did no damage, he says. It's highly suspicious, he adds, that this alleged incursion has taken place on the eve of the major Zapad 2025 military exercises between Russia and Belarus, which are slated to begin on September 12th. Even if they turn out to be Russian drones, it doesn't mean our side sent them into Poland. Plenty of our drones have fallen into Ukrainian hands, he says. I think this is a deliberate provocation, designed to drag NATO into the war against Russia. Igor Korochenko, editor-in-chief of the Russian magazine National Defense, echoed Mr. Litovkin's accusations. It is a clear example of an operation under a false flag, he argues. He claims that Ukrainian special forces launched the drone incursion to try to influence U.S. President Donald Trump's position on the war. Mr. Korochenko contends also that the drones Russia used could not have reached Poland. But if the 700-kilometer range, about 435 miles, provided by the Ministry of Defense is correct, the drones should have been capable of entering Polish airspace from Russian territory. Abbas Galyanov, a former speechwriter for President Vladimir Putin, turned Kremlin opponent in exile, suggests that the Russians are deliberately probing NATO's defensive capabilities and resolve. If we don't see a tough reaction from NATO, in the form of new sanctions or strengthened efforts to boost Polish air defenses, and probably some measures to protect the Ukrainian sky, Putin will be encouraged, he says. It means he'll soon be back with even bigger provocations. Next story. Facing uncertain future in U.S., Chinese scholars ponder a return home. The Trump administration's anti-immigrant stance has made Chinese scholars and students feel unwelcome in the U.S. Can Beijing persuade them to return home to work? By Ann Scott Tyson, Seattle. With her newly minted Ph.D. in International Relations from the University of Washington, a Chinese graduate student had high hopes of landing an interesting job in the United States. But after waves of applications and rejections, she's now broadening her search to Europe and her native China. The challenges have increased a lot, says Dan Wei, whose surname is being withheld to protect her privacy. The twin hurdles of the Trump administration's anti-immigration stance and billions of dollars in cuts to federal funding of universities and research institutions have made it much harder to find a job and sponsorship and stay in the U.S., she says. That is why I'm looking for jobs in China. Danway's travails are not rare among the hundreds of thousands of students and scholars from China who make up a major pool of intellectual talent at U.S. schools and research facilities. Students from China earn nearly 60,000 doctoral degrees at U.S. universities between 2011 and 2021, far more than students from any other country. The vast majority were in science and engineering fields, according to the National Science Foundation. Policies that threaten to drive such talent away from American shores could lead to a brain drain that would weaken the United States' international dominance in higher education and technology, experts say. Some 277,000 Chinese nationals are currently studying in the U.S. This is about to what extent the U.S. is still a welcoming society, especially for these Chinese scientists and scholars, says Yanbo Wang, Associate Professor of Strategy and Innovation at the University of Hong Kong. In May, Secretary of State Marco Rubio vowed that the State Department would aggressively revoke visas for Chinese students and increase scrutiny of all future visa applications from China and Hong Kong. Late last month, President Donald Trump appeared to reverse that stance, saying that Washington would issue 600,000 visas for Chinese students over the next 2 years. But that drew harsh criticism from Mr. Trump's MAGA base, reinforcing the feeling among Chinese scholars that they are persona non grata. The uncertainty impacts not only recent graduates, but top-notch Chinese scholars who have been working in the U.S. for decades, says Dr. Wang. Suddenly, they realize, I thought I was part of this melting pot society. Probably I was wrong, he says. This has triggered many of them to rethink their career prospects. Moreover, the Trump administration's cuts to federal grants are forcing scientists to reconsider whether the U.S. is a research-friendly environment, he adds. It's different in China. China, on the other hand, is eager to attract talent from the U.S. and is now building upon the success of long-standing programs to recruit top overseas scholars to work full-time at Chinese universities. One such program, the Young Thousand Talents Program, established in 2015, offers leading early career STEM scientists from foreign universities generous incomes, housing subsidies, and startup grants. Other incentives, including a lab, persuaded mid-career China-born scientist Hanqing Jiang to leave the U.S. after working at American universities for 20 years. He joined the faculty of Westlake University in China's eastern city of Hangzhou. "Someone showed me the lab space, and I was so amazed," he says. "It was my dream. I could have my own lab." Dr. Jiang, chair professor of mechanical engineering at Westlake, says his time in the U.S. was formative, giving him vital academic independence. "I developed my own research style during 15 years at Arizona State University," he says. But Westlake, a new research university supported by private and public funding established in 2018, offered him fresh opportunities to apply his research through cooperation with industry. He dived into robotics, developing a humanoid robot in his lab and launching a startup company. He hopes to train his robot in a real-world setting later this year. "I personally needed more space, a higher ceiling for my career," he says. Still, he acknowledges that moving back across the ocean is not an easy thing, especially for mid-career scientists. Indeed, so far, U.S.-based scholars such as Dr. Jiang, who returned to China, are in the minority. It's too early to see the real impact of the actions taken by the current U.S. administration, says Hong Kong University's Dr. Wang. The lure of America. For years, the overarching pattern has been for Chinese who earn doctorates in STEM fields to remain in the United States after graduation. About 90% of those graduating between 2000 and 2015 were still living in the U.S. as of 2017, and in 2023, 83% of those who earned their degrees between 2017 and 2019 remained in the U.S., according to the National Science Foundation data. For Angela, a student from China, who graduated in June with a master's degree in education from the University of Washington, visa uncertainty, as well as education funding cuts, complicated her job search. The Trump administration had begun revoking Chinese student visas, she says, and it seemed as though she needed a green card to get a teaching job in the U.S. She applied for about 100 positions without success. "It was super stressful. I told all my friends I was suffering from political depression," says Angela, who withheld her last name to protect her privacy. Her parents urged her to return to China, an option she was weighing when a friend helped her land a teaching job at a California middle school. "There's no perfect country in this world," says Angela. "But after evaluating my life and working conditions in China and the United States, I still feel like the United States is better for me." Now for some news briefs. Brazilian justices to convict ex-president Bolsonaro. The majority of a panel of Brazilian Supreme Court justices voted to convict former President Jair Bolsonaro of organized crime as part of his trial for allegedly attempting a coup to remain in office despite his 2022 electoral defeat. Once all five justices have voted, the panel will decide on Mr. Bolsonaro's sentence, which could amount to decades in prison. Mr. Bolsonaro has denied any wrongdoing and is currently under house arrest. A biodegradable mushroom kayak proved seaworthy. Mycologist Sam Shoemaker built the vessel using mycelium, the root-like structure of fungi, which he cultivated in a mold and dried for months before testing it at sea. He paddled 26.4 miles from Catalina Island to San Pedro last month, reports The Guardian. The material, which is lightweight, buoyant, and biodegradable, offers promise as an alternative to plastic. I'm pleased with how far this project has gone, but there's a long way to go, said Mr. Shoemaker. Saudi Arabia supplying Syria with crude to aid civil war recovery. It will provide 1.65 million barrels to help Syria rebuild its economy and infrastructure after a nearly 14-year civil war. The war ended last December with the fall of former President Bashar Assad in a rebel offensive. Since then, investors have flocked back to the country, including in the energy sector. The agreement between the Saudi Fund for Development and the Syrian Ministry of Energy is meant to enhance Syrian refineries and improve living conditions. Syria was once an oil exporter, but its economy collapsed due to war and sanctions. Albania appointed an AI bot as minister to tackle corruption. A new minister charged with handling public procurement will be impervious to bribes, threats, or attempts to curry favor. That is because Diela, as she is called, is an AI-generated bot. Prime Minister Edi Rama said Diela will help make Albania a country where public tenders are 100% free of corruption. The awarding of contracts has long been a source of corruption scandals in Albania, a Balkan country that experts say is a hub for gangs seeking to launder their money. The government did not provide details of what human oversight there might be for Diela. European Central Bank left rates unchanged. The bank left its benchmark interest rate at 2%, with inflation back under control and the economy weathering President Trump's tariffs better than expected. Trade uncertainty has clearly diminished, Bank President Christine Lagarde said. The focus in Europe has shifted to the fiscal crisis in France and any possible role for the ECB in containing potential market turmoil that could erupt from the country's out-of-control deficit and political logjam. Americans marking 24th anniversary of 9/11. Solemn ceremonies, volunteer work, and other tributes across the country are honoring the victims of the September 11, 2001 attacks. At the World Trade Center site in New York City, the nearly 3,000 victims' names were read aloud. At the Pentagon in Virginia, a memorial service honored the 184 service members and civilians killed. And near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, a similar ceremony honored the victims of Flight 93. The remembrances come during a time of increased political tensions, a day after conservative activist Charlie Kirk was shot and killed at a college in Utah. Belarus freed 52 political prisoners. President Trump had called on Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko a close ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin, to release detainees whom the U.S. leader has described as hostages. Belarus later confirmed their release. In return for the gesture, Washington will grant sanctions relief to Belarus's national airline. It was the biggest batch of prisoners yet pardoned by Mr. Lukashenko, who was seeking to repair relations with the United States after years of isolation and sanctions on his former Soviet state. The UK fired its ambassador to the US over his links to Jeffrey Epstein. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer fired Peter Mandelson over his links to the convicted sex offender. In a statement in the House of Commons on Thursday, Foreign Office Minister Stephen Doughty said the decision came after the publication this week of emails Mr. Mandelson sent to Mr. Epstein. On Wednesday, the Sun newspaper published emails that it said showed Mr. Mandelson telling Mr. Epstein to fight for early release shortly before Mr. Epstein was sentenced to 18 months in prison. All right, that's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, September 11th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.